outside your window may not be great, but everything is Wakanda forever here on Post Show Recaps. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Everything is Super. I'm your host, Kevin Mahadeo, and I am not here this week with my usual co-host, Josh Wiggler. That's right. We put the colonizer in chains and tossed him into the back of a van somewhere for this week's recording as we talk about Black Panther Wakanda Forever. I'm kidding. Josh is... he is somewhere. He's on vacation. Hopefully not in the back of a van. Hopefully he's fine. But we've brought on two very special guests to talk about this movie this week. You might be very familiar with them if you've been checking out Everything is Super for the past two months or so, as they have been covering She-Hulk here on PSR. Welcome, Jason Reed and Sasa Joseph. Guys, how's it going?
Kevin, things are great. I'm feeling uplifted. I'm feeling great after seeing Black Panther and happy to talk to you and my She-Hulk co-host, Sasha, about it. Can't wait to get into it.
Yeah, I can't believe that we're actually getting to talk about Black Panther. It's here. I've seen it once already. What a beautiful movie. And I'm so excited. I really am.
Yeah, this is going to be a really, I think, fun and great discussion for this film. Probably going to have, obviously, some emotional stuff to talk about. Let's start with overall experiences and thoughts, I guess, high level. Where'd you end up on your, I guess, I don't say rankings, but how'd you feel about the movie overall? Jason, how about you?
For a film that had a lot to get through, both emotionally and both kind of figuring out where to go with Wakanda, where to go with the Black Panther mantle, I thought that it did all the things very well. I did have some issues, but overall, I enjoyed it a lot. I really, really loved it. Of course, all of the Chadwick / T'Challa stuff hit home for me in a big way. So in terms of that, it really was successful for me.
Sasha, yeah. About you?
I think for me, it was just visually so beautiful. I think the last superhero movie, I mean, I just watched Black Adam, right? With it.
Yikes.
Yeah, we love to see it. With its, you know, yellow filter the whole time, right? All of it. I am a very big proponent of hating yellow filters on developing countries. But, you know, seeing all of that and then going back to Black Panther and just the beauty of the stories, the hidden meanings in everything, and what they're able to create, and how sad and how beautiful it was. It's just, for me, it was 10 on 10. Like, sure, there were holes. I don't even care, if I'm being honest. It was just so well done, and it really held such important representations all together. So I loved it.
Yeah, the comment about the yellow filter on Black Adam very much reminded me. There's this TikTok I saw recently, and now I want to check and see if this person has done more, where it was just like a series of stitches, and it was just like every time a Middle Eastern country is seen in a movie, and it's like the first person is like playing like a sitar, has like the very specific tune, and then someone else just comes in with it. You know, and then like someone else is just like a girl's in a burqa, and it's just like the zoom in on her face as the wind is blowing. Yeah. It's just every stereotype stitched over and over, and it was cracking me up. But you are so right about like how other movies do, I think, like just a certain filter and color and look of a place. And what makes, I think, Black Panther stand out so much, and I think, again, attributes to what I love about this movie, both the first and this one, is the vibrancy and the color and just this visual stunningness that comes through. As I mentioned, I got to go to a screening and I got spoiled senseless because I went to like a Dolby screening, which I don't think I've been to before.
Oh, wow.
And like Dolby is all about like, oh, the visuals are like, they really pop, like the contrast of colors. And they have a soundscape, the sound that just come from the speakers on the side in the front. It's like behind you, above you, below you, depending on stuff.
Oh,
so when we're
God.
Underwater, like when we're underwater scenes, the sound was coming from above us. So it's
wow.
Like we're underwater. Yeah. It was really a phenomenal experience. And I think regardless of that, I probably would have enjoyed this movie even beyond the actual biased theater experience. It was extremely well done. I think like Jason, I there are like things here and there that maybe I would be like, well, you know, I wish they did this or whatever. But overall, I really liked it. The themes especially, I think, hit me really strongly. The same thing with the first Black Panther. I think obviously having Ryan Coogler behind the helm and just having such a powerful Black cast behind there spoke to a lot of parallels to some real world discussions and issues, and was able to translate that extremely well for Marvel movies, considering they sometimes don't talk about, I think, the bigger issues in interesting ways. And yeah, there's just so much about it that I thoroughly enjoyed. And I'm really excited to like delve deep down into it. So let's do that. And I think we should probably start, I guess, the way the movie starts with the somewhat elephant in the room here, right? Tragically, Chadwick Boseman, who played Black Panther, passed away a few years ago. It was just a gutting thing, both I think for real world implications and also just as fans of superhero films. And this movie starts off with off screen, but discussing as it's happened. Shuri is essentially talking about how, oh, and also, I guess, spoilers. I should have prerequisited that, but if you're listening to this podcast, right. I mean, come on, this is spoiler territory, guys. Off screen, T'Challa is essentially dying as Shuri's like racing to find a cure. Doesn't work out. There's a whole thing about her not being there by his side as he passes away. And that's sort of like the kick of the movie. And both in terms of the characters and I think in the movie itself, like there is a looming shadow of T'Challa slash Chadwick in all of it. I really liked, I think, ultimately how they balanced that both in the beginning and the end, because it's a bookend type situation. Not going to lie, I was worried that they were going to pull some like Rogue One CG nonsense. Were either of you worried about that?
I was not, because I think shortly after Chadwick's death, when we finally got around to discussing what the plans were for the next Black Panther, it was like, no, we will not do any CG Chadwick, no CG Black Panther, nothing like that. So I didn't expect to see that. I was wondering how we would venture into T'Challa's death. How they would handle that. Would he die in battle? Would it be something, you know, some other attack? I was very happy to see that they kind of followed the real life events and said it was a disease. They don't specify in the movie what it was, but it was a disease that he didn't tell anyone until it was too late. And I was like, wow, they are really mirroring the real life events. I would be curious to know how you guys felt about the opening scene where we see her, like, it's in the last moments of Chadwick's life. Not Chadwick, sorry, T'Challa's life. And we're seeing her keep working. I didn't know if I liked that scene or not. I almost kind of wanted them to come in on it, on maybe the funeral scene. I didn't feel great about them coming in when we were in the final moments of his life. How did you guys feel about that?
I think we would have had too many questions if it came in straight at the funeral, where it's supposed to be this really amazing country that has all these STEM developments, right? And then all of a sudden we're like, oh, they just killed him of a disease. So I think I appreciated that there was some, you know, nod to like, we did try. It didn't work out. And I think that's what happened specifically to the cast in real life, where they were all in isolation when they found out and they couldn't believe it. And they, you know, and they were all working, they were whatever, all everywhere. And then it happened. So I wonder if that's also a piece of it as to why they chose to maybe not give Shuri and T'Challa that moment together. Cause that was hard, I have to say, but I just wonder if it really mirrored again, what happened where they found out super last minute also.
Yeah. I think that I like the scene in terms of the character arc for Shuri, right? Cause it is, I think there's a level of acceptance that needs to come with a moment like that, and being by his bedside, I think would have been something like, obviously, his mom was there for, and I think some of us would do if were we put into similar situations in real life. But like, her character so science and solution focused and forward that like, for her being there at the bedside wasn't enough. She should be doing something. So I think it really, and even in that moment, like, everyone was just like, hey, there's nothing you can do, and there's denial, because like, the movie certainly follows, I think, levels of the stages of grief, right? Like, she goes through denial, she goes through depression, she goes through anger, certainly. Until I think at the very, very end is acceptance, that moment at the end of the film. So I think it tracks with her character journey. And since the movie is trying to focus so much on like her character and how T'Challa's death looms over her and her not wanting to honestly move forward, it works in that way, you know? And I think it's interesting contrast of the funeral compared to also like the tragedy and silence of that opening moment. Because the funeral, obviously, there's a lot of like music and like celebration in a way, right? Because like certain cultures do celebrate death because it's not the end, it's just the next stage. So I did like the contrasting of those two scenes. I like that we honestly didn't see him in any way, shape, or form until the end of the movie. Not counting the Marvel Studios thing, right? Like, yeah. In the movie itself, in the story, we didn't actually see him until the very, very end. And that moment at the end, though, that was definitely the moment that it gut punched me, you know, like seeing those scenes was just, and I think that's what they're going for clearly, but that's where I really, really felt it.
Yeah, that's the moment it got me too, was at the very end. Yeah.
Yeah, same. I think if for me at the start, everyone in the movie theater, right? First of all, the complete silence that a full packed movie theater is able to do, I have never experienced that ever, because as soon as the Marvel credits start, y'all, we knew they would do something beautiful, but it's so powerful. And every all the lines we see in the Marvel opening is lines that that his character T'Challa has said in various movies that he's shown up in. So it's just to, you know, that level of detail, you know, with the silence on screen and in the show, it's just so powerful. And to be able to command that much from the audience, I was in awe.
I mean, it just seems like a no-brainer to do like a moment of silence with his like the Marvel openings, but it was still just so beautiful and majestic just to see him up there with and like you said, Sasha, the theater was just dead silent, because it's like everybody knows what this moment means and what this is. I thought maybe even they would do like the fanfare for the Marvel opening, but just have it dead silent and have him show. It just gives a moment for everyone to just kind of take it in and be like, yeah, this is what we're going to go into. So that decision, although it's seemingly a no-brainer, is so smart and so wonderful. I really enjoyed that part of it to begin the movie.
And I think it's so interesting because to Sasha's point too, right? Like, this happened during quarantine. Like, obviously, universally, there was a lot of mourning, but it all appeared digitally. It all appeared through Twitter, that firescape that's also going down. it was different. And I think having this moment in theater for all of us together to have these moments of silence, I think, across the world was really powerful and really great. Certainly, I think I really love this movie. I thought it was great, but there is that, like, I think, gaping hole, right? Like, it's hard to not think about and miss, you know, Chadwick Boseman playing T'Challa, because he was so good and was such an important character. And I don't think there's anything the movie could do. Like, if you feel it, you're going to feel it. And I don't think, like, for me personally, I just kept feeling it almost all the way through, like this missing piece that is so unfortunate that we are missing. And I think they did a good job of trying to, you know, move forward and progress the story as best as they could, but it's real difficult to pull something like that, considering like how important of a character he was and how phenomenal he was in that role.
Yeah, and I was actually also reading, I believe it's in a Vanity Fair article, where Ryan Coogler shared how he actually, him and the cat, the original cast, went to South Carolina before shooting started and visited, you know, the area. That's where Chadwick Boseman, you know, I believe is resting now. And they almost paid homage before starting the filming. So it's just, I feel that this whole film is just rooted in so much tradition, so much love, and, you know, and the attention to detail with everything is, yeah, it just shows up. And there is no Chadwick Boseman, and it is what it is, I think. But I agree that if Jason, I think you said this actually during She-Hulk, right? Where you wish that maybe different people could become the Black Panther when needed. And maybe that would have made a little bit more sense. But either way, it worked. It's just there's no Chadwick Boseman to fill that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think what I said at that point is like it would be like a shared responsibility where there would be a lot of Black Panther suits for like, you know, an M'Baku and Okoye or a Shuri. I think that would have been fun. I mean, we'll talk about it more as we go through the movie and how we felt about Shuri taking the mantle. But for what they had to do in this movie, I enjoyed what they did. I'll have to say. And, you know, going into the funeral scene, like, just to have that contrast between Shuri and then they're walking through the village and the villagers are all, you know, dancing. It's a celebration of T'Challa's life. Shuri's just kind of not in that mindset. She's not there. She's grieving so heavily. And to have that contrast and all the villagers dancing was so beautiful and so fun and does fit that culture that, you know, it's not the end, it's just moving on to a different plane. The ancestral plane was such a great moment, such a great, great scene for that. Did you guys want there to be any, for lack of a better word, cameos in the funeral of other Marvel, like, people to be there for this moment? Like, I thought maybe, like, a Bucky could have been there since he was, you know, in Wakanda. They deprogrammed him or whatever. What do you guys think? Did you guys think it could have added anything, or do you think it would have taken away from the Wakandans moment just for a kind of an outsider to be there?
They're so against, like, they literally call the nicest white person, the one nice white person that they have a colonizer, right? Like, even him. So I personally don't necessarily feel like it was missing that. Now that you say it, it's interesting. But I still feel that the Wakandans, I think, are still an insular country. And even though maybe they're a little more open than what's to come than the other country down way below, they're still pretty insular. So I don't know that letting folks in, like, quote unquote outsiders, colonizers, whatever we want to call, into this beautiful ritualistic space makes sense. Because I think that I'm thinking of, like, I have a relationship with Bucky, right, as Shuri or whatever, but my people don't. And they're seeing, all they see is maybe a white man, you know.
With a vibranium arm.
Yeah, with a vibranium arm, like, you know, hanging out. And not that folks can understand the importance. And I can see how that might, like, you know, instill some uneasiness within the everyday people.
Yeah, but I mean, I think in, like, Falcon and Winter Soldier, we saw a little bit of Bucky does have, like, a semblance of relationship with, like, the Dora Milaje. They know who he is. They know, like, and it felt from, I honestly forget which exact movie. Was it Black Panther 1 where we saw Bucky being the White Wolf in Wakanda, at one of the end scenes? So we know he's been there. We know that he's been part of at least a little part of the community. I just think some kind of representation from somewhere else in the Marvel Universe, I think, would have been an interesting thing to see.
Yeah, I go back and forth here because I do think it would be interesting. I actually didn't think of Bucky because I was thinking in my head, like, who would show up? And the only other person was, like, Cap. And I'm like, well, he dead. So, like, I was like, who would fit to be, like, a person who would make sense to show up in this scene? Well,
I mean, because everyone that he interacted with in, like, Civil War
is dead.
Is,
like, dead, right? Like,
Natasha, Steve, Tony.
Yeah.
Like, they're all gone.
They're all gone.
Mean, you could maybe do, like, a Rhodey. But, you know, Rhodey, that would have felt
maybe
a little
cheap. Clint, but then even then, that's weird.
Yeah.
I think it's it was, like, a situation like that. And that sort of made sense to, like, not have the cameo. I actually... This, and honestly, for me, this is actually addressing, like, a real bigger point for me, I think, from the movie, is that I actually really appreciate how insular and standalone the movie is compared to a lot of the MCU. I have been, personally, at this point, sort of beaten down by them trying to be like, guys, it all means something. And then, like, basically, because I'm like, no, it doesn't, you lying liars, lying to my face. Which is why I loved Love and Thunder so much, because it was such an insular, its own movie that didn't, like, tie too much to what was going on. And this felt the same way. And I kind of liked that I was just like, oh, good, I don't have to worry about the broader MCU, I guess.
I kind of feel you on that, but I also would say that the inclusion of Val in this kind of skews That's away true. From that. It makes me feel like, I mean, I'll get to one of my criticisms of the movie here, I guess, is that the inclusion or the wedging in of Val, and even to a lesser extent Everett Ross, even though he was part of the first movie, it seems a little forced in this, especially after we get through like the first couple of scenes. Once we get into scenes where they're talking about their former relationship, I was like, what does this have to do with the Black Panther? Like,
I love that though. I love the reveal that they were married.
I like that reveal. I just, well, did this need to be in this movie? It was my question.
That's a fair like, question. Yeah.
Should this be have been saved for the Thunderbolts? You know, property or what? Yeah. That to me felt a little wedged in.
I think
it was goofy, but
it was. But my bias towards loving Julie Louis-Dreyfus and Martin Freeman both, I think, may have. Of course, yeah. Like skewed my because like I that reveal I thought was delightful and tracks and also good for both of them. Right, into that pairing, and like, yeah, there was those parts. I mean, it was the like connection to the outside world, right? And like Val is this looming presence, I think, to an extent that we the audience knew because we knew her bigger score, so to speak, mm-hmm. as opposed to the characters within the film knowing she has ulterior motives. So I think those parts like kind of track, but all in all, though, it felt to me like to your point, though, like I do think the rest, it just feels like its own thing enough that it could bleed in from the previous movie without worrying about like the broader MCU. And I kind of really like that aspect. Although like that, this talk about the isolationism does bring me to a semi critique because we get it pretty quick, right? Like 1 year later, essentially, we jump into the future. And we have this situation where with T'Challa gone, Ramonda is running Wakanda. She is the queen of Wakanda. She is now in charge because everyone else is dead. And Shuri's too young. So like she's ruling Wakanda. And I like this part a lot and I love the implication, but I kind of wish we delved a little bit more because When I talk about one of my favorite things about the previous Black Panther film, it was the ultimate ending of Killmonger had a point to an extent, and T'Challa had to change, and Wakanda had to change, and that was the lesson to be learned. And it feels like with T'Challa gone, they regressed to be like, we are back to being isolationists. We're not opening our borders. We're not sharing stuff. We're not doing any of that. And I find that so fascinating and interesting because I do think it's such a like, reactionary thing to what Wakanda is doing and like to the loss of T'Challa. But I wish they delved more into that because I like the idea that there is the line of like you have to open up a little bit, right? And like not to appease France, but to help, you know, other people of color in the world. And I think like that was the key hook of why T'Challa made that decision. So the idea of like going back on that a little bit, I think is fascinating, but they didn't delve into it enough. We certainly saw quote unquote the consequences of doing that. But I don't know, like for me, like that was one of the things that I wish they'd kind of focus a little bit more on, but I don't think they hit that note really well. What are your thoughts?
For me, like you said, it did get dropped pretty fast. I think once we get into the Namor of it all, it gets kind of pushed to the back burner. And I do think it may have also been a way for them to maybe have a setup for the next movie, where we do have that conflict between Wakanda and the U.S. But yeah, it did feel like it was ramping up, and then it just kind of died down. So there was no big consequence to that. So you're right about that. I just feel like. And that scene where we have, you know, the France, you know, army coming in,
right?
They open the doors and like,
oh, that was so steps good.
Out. I was like, let's go. So like, that was such a monumental scene. And I mean, so my like MVP of this movie, for at least the first three quarters, was Angela Bassett.
Yeah.
Just as Ramonda, and where she's in front of that I don't know what you want to call it, that the UN or the mm-hmm. commissioner, whatever you want to call it, and she's giving that speech about like, you guys thought we were weak, you guys thought this and that, and then they bring in the soldiers was so powerful, and just the level of stepping up that everyone had to do in this movie from, you know, the supporting cast of the first movie was so tremendous, because we had Angela Bassett, Ramonda in the first movie, she wasn't that big part of it. But she stepped up here. Winston Duke and Baku stepped up here in this movie. And just to see that was so fantastic. And like for her, like in this speech, and we'll get into the speech later where she's talking to Okoye, just magnificent acting from her. She's like I said, my MVP of the movie. So yeah, those parts of it were fantastic for me.
I also think this scene served as a stepping stone for what is going on. Yep. Because one agreed with the, like, this is probably a setup for future. But I think we have not seen any of these people shine in the same way, right? Because they were never supposed to. And now all of a sudden, we're like, okay, we need to see them shine. We need to see them, you know, have power, and not just perceived power, but actual power. So I think that they needed to show that, listen, we don't have a Black Panther with us, but that doesn't equal y'all are going to mess around in that, you know, dead space. We need to just lock everything down and pause. So I feel that Wakanda was on a pause to decide what the heck we're going to do. That's why I understand. And I don't necessarily disagree with what they did or why, you know, they're not sharing, because even though they're on pause, these people are messing around and showing up. Okay. France, I see you, lady. So I think that this whole scene and sequence, right, we needed to show that the Dora Milaje are still just as badass as ever, and that, you know, they have the step up on all these people, regardless of how we may come off, quote unquote. So that's what I saw this. And to me, it was like, we're setting up powerful Black women to take up space and to be like, no, like, we got this and we will be fine without a Black Panther, like, just government, yeah, right, wise. So that's why it worked for me, because listen, when they came, not even when they came in, when they in Mali, when they opened the vault, right, and it's just the faces, I was like, it's a wrap, it's done for you, like, you're, everyone's dead, bye, I love it, we're back, baby, you know, like, I'm safe. So, and interestingly enough, I don't know if y'all have seen The Woman King, spoilers for The Woman King if folks haven't, but that's actually very similar to the opening scene in Woman King, where Viola Davis, like, it's all of them, they come up and it's like just black and it's just their faces. So I think that's a beautiful shot that we needed to see to showcase the power of the people that, you know, we're just like level 2, level 3, the names we maybe didn't even know. So now all of a sudden we need to know them because they're now the story.
Yeah, I thematically, I mean, it's amazing to see all of these characters and all these extremely incredible Black women like step up in here, right? And that opening, like that scene, it's the epitome of the French F around and they found out.
Exactly.
Like, I also think it was a good scene to illustrate, like, okay, yes, this is a movie about grieving. This is a movie about loss and all that. Yeah, but we still gonna F some shit up. Like, we're still a semi-action movie. So don't get that twisted. So I think it helps to kind of illustrate the blend of all the themes and all the topics that are going to go on in this movie.
Yeah, it's truly, because like that's the thrust of it. There's always like the emotional conflict, right, with the characters in the film. And then there's the like broader external conflict. And external conflict absolutely bleeds into, I think, what's going on and like the French doing what they did. Because it is a very much the mentality of the rest of the world. And the point of that scene is that like, with the Black Panther gone, everyone thinks that like now is our chance. Wakanda's weak. They don't want to give us our resources. We'll just take it. And it's like, uh-uh. And I really love that part of it. On the note too, before I hit the next note, the big thing here, I definitely want to double down on Angela Bassett in this movie. Holy shit. Like the scene I think I've thought about most coming out of this is that moment, you know, partway through where Shuri is gone missing and she is confronting Okoye in the throne room. And the acting on that woman. Oh, my God. Like, her anger and sadness and rage as she talks about, like, her family is gone. Like, I cannot stop thinking about how good that scene was and how much she acted the shit out of that moment. It was so incredible.
Yeah, I mean, she's dressing down Okoye, and they're talking about, like, you know, the one of the other elders are like, yeah, well, she betrayed her husband or whatever. It's like, yeah, well, she gets to visit her husband if she wants to. Like, I don't get that. Oh, I don't get anything. My husband is dead. My son is dead. My daughter is, like, I almost wanted to clap. I wasn't in the theater. I'd have been clapping. But, like, you know, I was just, like you said, the acting in that scene and the first scene we just talked about were things that really stand out in my mind as I think about this movie and think about Angela Bassett. Those are what will stand out for me for a long time to come in this movie. So, yeah, she killed it for me. She was definitely stood out among everyone else and really upset me when what happens with her later in the movie happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's also open spoilers. We're allowed to, like, talk out of order.
Yeah, I was pissed when they killed her. I was pissed off.
Why did they need to do that? I was like, what is the reason? No, you're wrong.
I said no. I said they're not going to do that. They're not. They just killed off. They just killed Shuri's brother. They're not going to kill her mother, dude. Like, that's crazy. And they're like, no, she's gone. I'm like, no, wait. What? Like, I was so upset at that moment.
Yeah, I just feel like this is where, right, these acting performances, these moments were when it was pulled out of just being a superhero blockbuster and it became like a legit contention of like just a good movie period, not just in like a Marvel or not just in a super hero kind of space, but in like period. It is a good movie and deserves, you know, its flowers. And listen, if these people don't at least get nominated for an Oscar, like, I will be fighting people.
Yeah, I mean,
Angela Bassett deserves it after
that. For sure. Angela Bassett should be number one on that. I fear that the, you know, the, what you want to call it, or the view of quote unquote comic book movies will always hamper that, unfortunately. Absolutely. For me. So, like, I think as much as we think they deserve, as much as we know they deserve it, I just don't know if it's going to happen.
Well, it's why this always comes, like, and it is unfortunate, but it is always post-mortem, even in comic books, right? Like, Heath Ledger won when he died. Like, it's always, like, that's how it ends up being. And that's a whole Academy issue that we don't need to rant about. It's an entire other podcast that we can rightfully complain. Just the Get Out thing, where it's just like, oh, well, I didn't actually see it, so I didn't vote for it. You old white, but anyway.
Listen, that's actually exactly what we're going to discuss today.
That's true. the acting in this movie was so spectacular. And I get, like, why her character ended up dying, because it had to be a situation where Shuri's put into not a role as a daughter in Black Panther, but as a potential future leader in Black Panther. Because, like, that would have to be a situation to help her make her ultimate decision at the end when it came to Namor. And I think, for those reasons, right? Like, that's why that had to happen. It is a tragedy. It's the same way I feel about, like, Spider-Man No Way Home, where I'm like, presumably we've all seen it. Yes. And if you haven't, by the way, spoilers, the losing Marissa Tomei, I'm like, no! You're losing a legend.
Boy, this phase of the MCU is real brutal. Yeah, like, we have to kill off parental figures in this phase of the MCU.
You're going full classic Disney animated.
That's
no
what I was saying. I was like, is this a Disney effect? Because I'm over it. Okay. I just have to say this, but all our characters don't have to go through, like, they can go through grief, right? They need a turning point. I get it. The plot needs to, you know, have move around, blah, blah, blah. But, like, my God, they don't need to be battered with, like, everything.
As She-Hulk says, all your heroes don't need to be, you know, orphans with daddy issues.
Thank you. Okay, She-Hulk has yelled about this, and I don't want to yell about it anymore. Stop this.
I will say one thing, like, it's for me, I'm a huge Superman fan. This is pretty well known. One of my favorite things that they did in, like, the 90s, I want to say. Actually, I think it was, like, it started in Crisis, after Crisis on Infinite Earths. But Superman's parents, both his Kryptonian ones and his regular parents in the past, were both dead. And that changes. Jonathan Kent, his dad, his Earth dad, I guess, dies of a heart attack. It's an interesting thing when you do the story that way, because heart attack killing him is brilliant, because it's the one thing Superman can't stop. But, like, that element of, like, oh, his parents have to be dead, I don't like. And in the 90s especially the Justice League and the Superman animated series did a great job in that both of Clark's the Kents were alive and he would get to visit them. And I think that adds a whole new element to this character and his story. And I wish that was the case, where it's like you said, the parents would need to be dead the whole time, right? Like, we don't all need that. Like, holy crap. But I, again, in the case of this, I see why it happened, but like,
right.
It would be great if we still had Angela Bassett in the future. Yeah.
Listen, watching that with your mom, and me and my mom are just like, oh my God, because I went to watch it with my mom, and she just like stares at me when the mom dies, and I was like, come on, not this. She's like,
so you're going to miss you when I'm gone?
Yeah, literally, and I was like, no, don't do this. Let's move on, because I can't. Okay, it's too much death. I don't need it.
All right, let's talk about, like, because that's a good segue into the broader themes of where we're going, because the reason why this attack happened by the French was, and the part that I do like, despite my criticism about, like, oh, I wish it was more about, like, the contrast of what T'Challa was going for versus what ended up happening, is that, shockingly, who could have seen this twist coming, is that when Wakanda was just like, we're not just going to give you vibranium, all the rest of the world, specifically the very white world, decided, well, we're just going to try and take it because we want it. And everything belongs to us in some way. And if we want something, we should get it. So, like, that's essentially the impetus, is the idea that they want vibranium. And if Wakanda's not going to get it, we'll either take it by force or find some other way to get it. And they find vibranium on the sea, where we discovered that's where Namor is. And his people have vibranium access as well. And they have stayed especially hidden for a very long time. But because they're coming in to take vibranium from them, this leads to the major conflict of the movie. I will say I love that concept because holy shit, reality, right? Like, reality. There is a resource that these other people want, and they will go to the countries that have them. And if it means putting those countries and the people in those places in conflict with each other, all the better for the other people trying to come in. Like, this idea of destabilization to nations, just so you can sweep up the pieces, it is the most Eurocentric thing I've ever heard, and so goddamn accurate. So the fact that this is the thrust of the film, I was already just like, clap, 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 clap. I was very much into that. What did you guys think?
Yeah, as someone that obviously comes from a colonized nation, I was like, here we go again. They're back, baby. It never ends. And guess what? This time it's our own people. So, aka America. But I think this is folks that maybe, you know, aren't aware of, like, not only history, I think current events of how, you know, the war, a few wars that we have fought for oil, but, you know, under the guise of many other reasons. It has been fascinating because I think if you don't put two and two together, this concept of colonization, taking what's ours and being the superpower, and how do we stay the superpower? Well, we have to weaken other people. And that's just how, you know, white supremacy benefits from all of us. And when I say white supremacy, I mean the not white people. I just mean the concept of white supremacy. Well, no, because
I know. I was making
white
a joke.
People too. But you know, it's so on the nose because of just how countries are still warring to this day because of something colonizers did, right? Miss Marvel. Why are India and Pakistan still warring? Like, listen, the World Cup happened. India's not in it. And why am I mad? Because we don't get to play Pakistan. Hello, it's the same country. It should have been the same country.
Yeah.
So it's just colonization has created so much trauma in our bodies, right? Mm-hmm. That we have no, that we consciously maybe know, but I think unconsciously deal with all the time. And that to see that on screen and so beautifully, I think, adapted, just it felt seen because I was like, yep, there we go, colonization getting us again. Why are we fighting each other when the scientists, like, because in my mind, I'm sorry I'm jumping ahead, but I was like, fine. It's not Riri's fault. I was like, just tell him the story of what happened, and she didn't build it, you know, maliciously. They stole it. Let's talk about that. Instead, maybe he'll give her, you know, freedom, or he'll let her live. So that's just how I feel, at least personally, is that all of this trauma that's in our bodies was now, I feel like, on screen. And that's why I think it was one of the reasons I loved watching. And of course, just how easily they were able to defeat these Navy SEALs, right? I think it was joint CIA Navy SEALs, whatever. Mm-hmm. Top people, basically. I was like, hey, look at them. Just going.
Well, that scene in particular was such a great introduction to the I'm sorry, what do we call it? I want to call
them Atlanteans. Not Atlanteans. Yeah, in the comics, they are Atlanteans.
The Talokans. To see them, the Talokanis, to see the Talokanis introduced this way was so effective and so terrifying.
Yes.
And just for like, especially like the siren call that had all the soldiers jumping overboard. It was so like, so creepy and so effective, like almost horror movie-like. Was such a great introduction to them. And just to have like at the end where, you know, Namor comes up and he, you know, whips the helicopter around just to see him like up in the air. You don't even see his little wings flapping. He's just up in the air as this ominous figure that we don't see his full profile yet, which is so effective and so wonderful. You know, a little bit of a waste of Lake Bell. I was a little surprised that that she was in such a small role. I almost think parsing through the threads of the movie, I almost thought like, was she supposed to be the inventor of that like vibranium thing? And then last minute we made a substitution for Riri or whatever, but I don't know. But just to see that scene was so fun and effective and a great set piece, a great action piece, really.
Yeah. So much of this movie, I mean, the threads of the plot are intricately tied together. But I love their introduction. We'll touch on the entirety of Namor and the Talokanians. Talokanis? Again,
yeah.
I don't know what the official designation is here. Some linguist knows, but it's not me. In a moment for sure as a whole. But I definitely want to echo what Sasha said too, is that the thing I love the most about this movie was its central theme, because of the one of vibranium and that they had someone who invented something that could find it. Namor specifically wanted the Wakandans, because they didn't want to reveal he didn't want to reveal his people to the world, because they want to say more than isolation. It's just invisible and hidden and not known, to send the Wakandans who are known to capture this scientist and bring them to Namor and his people to deal with. And that sort of leads to the thrust of it. It eventually leads to the conflict in this because of things that occur and like vengeance when Shuri gets taken and like retaliation, leading to the ultimate, like the big battle is between the Talokanians and the Wakandans. But ultimately, the theme of the movie for me is of course just like, stop it. You should not be fighting each other.
Exactly.
There's a bigger.
It's the Americans. Get the Americans.
Get that. Like the way that just keeps like this rings true. And I like that's what I've loved about the first Black Panther. That's what I love about this. And I think like obviously there's the writing and the behind the scenes of it all. I just got to give, you know, so much props, especially Ryan Coogler, who I think is just like a phenomenal director, but also like, Creed is a perfect example. I'm a giant ass Rocky fan. I love Rocky. But when I saw the first Creed, I was like, you have no right to be this good. Like, and it is entirely, I think, Ryan Coogler and Michael Jordan, obviously, who like made that what it is. And I think similarly here, drawing on these real life themes, because Jesus effing Christ, the way we have seen this, especially God in the last like, you know, 8 years, especially, or however much at this point, has been this conflict that brews between different groups of people infighting and preventing him from getting rid of the real bad people.
Yes.
You know, this election, they have finally been the moment where enough young people and enough minorities are like, all right, no, we got to stop this shit. So like, it can be done. But this idea is so fantastic and so powerful. And like they're not over the like hit you over the head with it, which I truly love. It's not like, oh, this is like knock you, like this is what's happening, see? But like if you read it and you understand it, you can get it. For me, I absolutely get it. Because like for me, coming from a South American, my family is from Guyana, which is a South American country, but that has its own extremely similar history with colonization and pinning people against each other. Because, quick history lesson, Guyana being a British colony, British Guyana at the time, was, of course, colonized by the British. And for a long time, they essentially brought slaves over to, you know, feel the land, do the stuff that they, terrible things that they do with slaves. Then the British, out, like, abolished slavery for everywhere but America. And essentially at that period, they were like, well, we can't have slaves anymore in Guyana, so what do? I got an idea. We have India. That's this other colony over here. Let's do this thing called indentured servitude, where it's not slavery, but, you know, we could get them. And so we'll bring them from India, like, have them sign a contract, be like, hey, if you come here and work, you could get rewarded afterwards. It's like, okay. And then they brought a bunch of Indian people over there. And so there's a ton of Indian people in Guyana. However, once they were there, conflict happened because this newly freed slaves were trying to get legitimate jobs because they could do so now. Meanwhile, they brought over all these people from India and said, well, we brought you over to work these fields, but you're in competition now against these people who want the same jobs you do. So, like, what are we going to do? I guess it's a wage spiral to the bottom.
Yes.
Who are we going to pay less? And they successfully turned Indian people and Black people against each other, which isn't even to account for the Native people who lived in South America. So, like, all of this stuff, like, is so real to, like, literally experiences I saw in, like, happening with Guyana, and the long-lasting ramifications amongst my own family members is wild. So, like, all of this hits so true, like, looking at this and being like, yeah, this is exactly how it goes. They somehow managed to, like, turn us against each other. But then have the ending being like, we got to stop. Listen, we should not be fighting each other. There's other issues to deal with. So thematically, I love that piece of it personally. That is my take. So let us do stop in though on Namor and the Talokotians. Holy shit. This is obviously a new interpretation of this character to an extent. He still has that bit of, like, kingly arrogance that Namor has in the comics, but obviously this is so much more influenced by Native culture, and especially, like, Aztec and Incan and Spanish culture as well. Like, I honestly love what they did here. It was blown away by how well the story was done and how well his backstory was done.
Yeah, I think if we like compare it to the comic counterpart, it's definitely a little different. But I think this is better. Like,
yeah.
The comic counterpart is a lot more arrogant, a lot more, you know, he's even a little seductive. He's like Mr. Steal Your Girl to Mr. Fantastic, trying to get Sue Richards in the comics. But this was, you know, and you felt a little bit of a kind of a chemistry between Namor and Shuri in moments. But this was, he was, you know, much like in Black Panther 1 with Killmonger, this was a villain you're kind of right. Damn, like, I don't want you to be right, but you kind of are. You got to have a point here. So I think in that respect, like, just like we did in Black Panther 1, we conveyed it very, very well. And we even got a great backstory that didn't take up a whole big part of the movie, because it couldn't, because we had so much to do. But they really conveyed his backstory in a quick yet very efficient way of understanding who he is and why he's doing the things he's doing.
Yeah, I also have to say the idea of how they built him, right? And the way they took, so Talokan is actually taken from, or heavily inspired, sorry, by a real, you know, Aztec culture a story where it is Talalocan, and it's described as a place, a paradise. And interestingly enough, it's ruled by the rain deity, which we do see in, it's the god they pray to, and his consort. But what's fascinating about it is that this city absorbed those who died through drowning or lightning, and as a consequence of diseases associated with the rain deity. So to me, it's like even the base, right, of all of this is that they're building on how do we create a flawed character, but that actually is someone that folks identify with. Well, let's turn to what our ancestors already tell us about it, and then we'll go from there. And I wasn't mad at him. Listen, until he killed my girl, I wasn't mad at him. Yeah. I was like, where is the lie? Like, y'all came to him, started looking for his stuff and his vibranium, and now he gotta get you back. I don't think he's wrong. And then all of a sudden people are fighting each other, you know? So it's just the whole piece of him and him being the first mutant. I heard it. Yep. I was like, stop teasing me. You're killing me, Marvel.
Come on, guys. Fight you. Stop using that word if you're not going to give us.
And listen, it fits because in the comics, he's also the first.
Yeah,
mutant.
The first mutant.
So
exactly.
It's, you know, it was such a fun, it was such a great moment to hear him say it out loud. Like, oh, okay, there it is. We're checking in. There's mutant word.
Yeah, so I feel like just pulling from the comics and real life stories and real life culture and religion is what makes him so compelling and so beautiful. And I mean, the costume designing, my God, it's out of control with how just amazing everything looks.
What I especially love about it, like the backstory is to me phenomenal. Like I just the idea of how they were formed as a people, how they ended up under the sea, so to speak, and their culture and survival. But then the moment that for me obviously was just like, holy shit, was when he comes out to bury his mom.
Oh my God.
He sees the slavers. And then
little Namor don't play, bro. Namor don't play.
In my classic, the way I always say it too, like once the slavers are all killed, I was like, oh no, they died. Like, oh, it's just,
what
like,
a shame.
Yeah, what a shame. That's all. Yeah, that scene was so well done. But like, okay, it is a thing in writing and in especially comics, right? Like they always say the quintessential thing is you have your antagonist as a dark reflection of your protagonist. Many early writers and people who don't really think about it will just make them literally the same with the same powers, like down to the same powers, except one is good and one is bad, and that's it. What Black Panther 1 and Wakanda Forever accomplished so well is taking that idea, and in Black Panther 1 it is a similar circumstance of same powers, but this one it is not, but showing how they are so similar to each other but so different to each other. And it shares, that's what ends up bonding them and helping them understand each other. It's like, it's not just a dark reflection. It is the circumstances or whatever, their philosophies are different for X reason, but they share also some similarities in heart that are still the same. And ultimately, Namor and Shuri, and you know, really whoever's ruling Wakanda, are very, very similar. Their people are similar. Like, because the idea that they became the same way from this flower and plant that they found is similar to how the Black Panther gets their power. The idea like he's doing everything he can to keep his people safe is the same thing that Ramonda was doing, and to an extent T'Challa was trying to do. It's what Shuri's gonna have to end up doing as the new ruler. There's so much similarities between the two characters, and I think that's so important and so vital. And their origins and their people and their culture, the importance of culture and traditions to them is so vital. And then it really unifies the two groups. And you see how they were both similar and how they were both different. And to me, again, that's such like excellent, smart writing that it just works so well to the point where when that moment happens at the end, when Shuri's faced with the decision, a lot of times it could feel just like, oh, I guess she just changed her mind because the plot demanded it. But to me, it did make sense when you saw what she was referencing, when she's realizing how much their cultures and their people are the same. I thought that worked so well, and that came with the development of Namor and the people of Telecon. So, like, just incredibly well done.
Yeah, I think when we talk about the ideologies, it's interesting that the Wakandan ideologies even changed a little bit since T'Chaka to T'Challa, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. we get this scene where Shuri's in the, you know, I don't know if we want to call it the astral plane or where we're gonna go with the, I mean, boom. I mean, big surprise, Eric Killmonger
love
is
it.
Here.
Love that movie.
It's so good.
And he talks about, like, what do you think T'Chaka would have done with that scientist? Like, he would have given the scientist over. Mm-hmm. But when we transferred power over to T'Challa, and with T'Challa's experiences, things have changed. Like, we are not going to do that. Like, if T'Chaka was king, he would just be like, all right, Namor, here's your scientist. Like, leave us alone, thanks. And just to see that ideology change and to see Shuri kind of weigh that out. I mean, she never even thought about giving up Riri, but just to see her weigh her ideology as the Black Panther, do I kill this guy? Do I let him live? And letting her mother influence that was so powerful and so wonderful. Just to see her come into that mindset on her own based on her influences.
Yeah, it's another reason like it's so well done, right? Like again, the pacing and the story structure plays out so perfectly in this film, I think, for that reason. And then you mentioned this character, and so I do want to hit on this, right? Like, we can jump back and forth. There's no structure here. We're not making a movie, so we don't have to worry about that. But you mentioned Riri. This is Riri Williams, who in the comics is known as Ironheart, who became the Iron Man-like character, has her own suit. We get all of that in this movie. But I have to ask, if I was the only one. So I famously don't watch trailers. I don't observe spoilers. I avoid everything. So I went into this movie not having seen or read anything. The only thing I knew was about Letitia Wright and her real world stuff, which, that's all I knew. So I went in not knowing. So when they said, there is a scientist who built a machine that could detect vibranium, my hand like clenched on my armrest because I thought it was a different scientist also associated with Black Panther and Namor. And for a hot second, I was like,
Reed Richards.
Yeah.
This the movie that it's going to happen?
That's interesting. I wish I could live your life, Kevin. I wish I could live your life with going into something completely dark.
It takes work.
Yeah. If this is the segment we're talking about Riri, if I think about it after the fact, I don't know that she made a huge impact on me. What did you guys
think? I'll die for her.
I loved her character. I just felt like if you removed her from the movie, would we have noticed?
I mean, I feel like that's for a lot of folks in the movie, right? Where that's what a beautiful cast and a strong cast does, where they can carry and plug in the holes when the other person isn't around. But I will say, I think this was a lot of universe building, unfortunately, and that's where she was part of that piece of more the universe building, not necessarily the Black Panther Wakanda Forever story. But she was great. She's young. My question is also, she's at MIT with another MJ, ?
Yeah.
So what does that mean? So that's why, again, I felt that she was great universe building. Also, we did get the biggest plot point from their interaction because she had a heater up, right? And the Okoye. Sorry. It was like, what are you going to do? Kill Namor with the heater? Yes, that's actually exactly what we're going to do.
That's actually very funny. I didn't think about that. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's
a good one. So it's just, I think all of that, right? She had very subtle moments of, I think, being the vehicle for where the plot needed to go, where we needed Shuri to show up and go be the savior for someone. It's not going to be for, you know, Adora Milaje. It's probably going to be for someone that actually needs her help, that's young, that she identifies herself with, aka a young scientist. Yeah, so that's why I feel like there was a lot of moments that we just needed Riri so that our A-team could actually be the A-team and actually like show up and do whatever they needed to do. Again, like, when Riri's lines are out of control, because then she's like, yo, this is some Princess Leia, you know, Beauty and the Beast shit. When Shuri has to dress up. So it's so funny, right? So I just felt like that was her job and that's fine. And we get Ironheart out of it. So great. Why not?
I will also forever defend Beauty and the Beast against haters because the way people read that movie is incorrect. Like the whole like, it's about Stockholm Syndrome. I'm like, no, it's not. It's about a society that has put its values into the wrong thing, because the whole thing about Bell's Village is they worship Gaston, who is a misogynistic asshole, and they worship him. The problem is the city. That's the lesson.
Listen, Kevin.
Welcome to our Beauty and the Beast TED Talk.
Yeah. No. Kevin, I will die on this hill that you are maybe Stockholm Syndrome by this movie. Because both can be true. We are dimensional people. And guess what? Many things are wrong. Stockholm Syndrome is just one issue of that damn movie.
Sure. But that's a different podcast.
Yes. Come later for the Disney issue podcast.
Yeah, okay, so I will say, I do see Jason's point, but I also see Sasha's point in that, I mean, Riri's essentially like a living MacGuffin, right? She's an element that's helping drive the plot forward. I do think she contributes emotional stuff and arcs for Shuri.
I also think that because Shuri can't necessarily be the comedic relief, which she was in Black Panther 1, I think Riri Williams stepped in to that role in this movie, which I think was a very great part of her character. I'm sorry, Kevin, go ahead.
No. That is a very, very valid point. But like, in terms of like, to your heart of the question, your iron heart of the question, would she make a difference? And it's that honestly is hard to say. I will admit, right? I think what they could have done with this and would have hooked everything back together. This is one of those, like, if I could change something, I would have emphasized the fact that Riri is someone who is obviously a hyper intelligent black woman out in the regular world, did not have access to technology Wakanda does, is struggling to accomplish a lot, selling a lot of the stuff she's doing just to make it through. She has her own workshop, but she's been hustling nonstop. She's trying to survive in a world that doesn't acknowledge and respect her or see her as an equal. This is exactly what Eric Killmonger was talking about in the first movie. If you loop that all back in together about them sliding back into isolationism and they see Riri out there trying to do this and trying to survive, and that is a thing for Shuri, especially to be like, T'Challa was right. My mom, like, regressing was not the way to go. There's people like Riri out there that we need to extend out to and we need to help. Not the French people, not these, you know, colonizing MFers, but our people who are struggling. That would have unified everything back and had Riri serve like a real solid purpose to bring, I think, Wakanda and everything back to where it needed to be. That would have been, I think, a way to like solve it and like have Riri there. I think also, like, in my defense of not knowing anything on this, I understand why it ended up being Riri Williams, right? Like, after they said kid, I was like, oh, it's Riri. Like, my brain clicked because I knew there was another smart, and like thematically it makes sense because it's a movie about like powerful black women, so having it be Riri was sensible. Now you might be thinking the reason why I was like Reed Richards and like it wouldn't work because, again, like he is white. Not in my headcanon, because this would have been the perfect time, the perfect moment to have Reed Richards and have him be a black man. Because like, if it, again, if you got William Jackson Harper showing up, I would have flipped my like the theater in excitement, like holy shit. Obviously, again, thematically it all makes sense. Fantastic Four coming eventually. Still crossing my fingers that the reality is that he will be a black man, but we'll see. But yeah, I think that's a way that could have maybe solved the Riri Williams issue. It was cool seeing her in the Ironheart outfit at the end, though. Like, that ending fight as a whole was pretty cool. I mean, honestly, the action throughout, I thought, was pretty A+. What did you guys think in terms of the action, especially compared to the first movie? Where were you on some of the action scenes here?
I think in terms of, I'll take it in two pieces. The boat fight was interesting, if not a bad idea from the Wakandans' standpoint.
Correct.
Thank you.
And then the Shuri Namor fight was so brutal and so fantastic. Like, to see her like impaled on shrapnel, and she's gotta like pushes like self off of it. I was like,
where's the
God,
blood? But anyway,
well, I mean, it's a PG-13 movie.
Yeah, the blood is in the rating.
So to see that be so brutal and to see her plan come to fruition like it did, so genius, and to have that in that end moment where she does the Wakanda Forever and it blasts Namor, I was like, oh my gosh. And then for her, you know, of course, her decision whether or not to kill him or not, but then to go back to the boat, see everyone cornered, and Namor and Shuri up there, like, Namor's like, yeah, we're not fighting anymore. If I was Namor, I'd be like, you know what? No, maybe we're still fighting. Maybe not truce for real.
Jason, you missed the theme of the movie. We just talked about
it. Seems
about
like
this.
We got him on the ropes. It seems like we can win this now.
I'm just saying.
I'm just saying. There's no honor among bad guys, supposedly, but like,
he's not bad. That's the point.
We know who the real bad people are.
They didn't talk about it enough in the movie, but we know who the real baddies are. It's not my guy.
I understand. You know, 5 minutes ago, he was trying to kill Shuri. And I was like,
you're very Slytherin of you right now, I have to say.
That's my house, I gotta tell you. But anyway, so yeah, the action was fantastic, even on the boat, even though it was a bad idea to like face them out on a boat where they had like so many other,
like, what are y'all doing, bro?
The fight scenes were fantastic. The Midnight Angel suits were interesting to me. Those were the suits that Shuri came up that with, mm-hmm. that Okoye and Anika ended up wearing. I wish that we got a little more attention on them. I wish if we couldn't have done that, we would have saved it for the third movie, because there's a lot of story involved in those suits in the comics. I wish we could have tackled that, you know, in another movie, because it really just felt tacked on. It didn't feel like real. So I would have wished we could have saved that for another feature, but that's another thing. Ironheart, fantastic, but again, didn't feel like we got a lot of story into that suit. It just kind of happened. It was kind of there. But this,
they say
the
you watched Iron Man before. You know what this is.
Like, true. Leave it alone. True. We got the montage of her like beating the metal, so I guess that's good enough. But yeah, I think as far as the choreography goes, all of it was fantastic. All of it was great. To have the Dor Milaje rappelling off the side of the boat with the Jabari land people holding him up was just so so fantastic. So yeah, all in all, I think that all worked out well. We did not get a climactic CGI against CGI fight. So for that, I am very thankful.
Yes.
I'm looking at you, Black Adam. But for that, I am so thankful.
It also, I have to say, for Jason and I specifically, coming off of a She-Hulk.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
CGI worked here.
Yes.
This is where that finale scene where the robot,
they went to Black Panther.
Yeah, so. Where the robot Kevin is like, yeah, we are diverting other resources to other things, and we get the Wakandan drum beat. It showed, because we didn't have any CGI issues here.
Yeah.
Exactly. So all I'm saying is, I was just for Marvel because I was like, I think it's a wrap for them. I don't know where all these people went. Then Black Panther came out and it was all good.
Like, oh, that's where they were.
Yeah. Yeah, got it. I get, money is tight. We love capitalism. But it's but it looked so clean. And I actually agree with you, Jason, on the on a Midnight Angel, that piece as well, where I just don't know why they needed to show it, because it was comical, right? Okoye hated it, and all of a sudden she's wearing it and not being the badass Dor Milaje outfit, right? First of all, also, can we point out, Dor Milaje, they're like regular quote-unquote outfits, as in out of uniform. I need all of them. Like, how do I non-culturally appropriate and wear that?
I need more home life of the Dor Milaje.
Because every outfit these people are wearing, I need the breakdown.
In this movie, when Shuri was at the college, I was like, God,
Shuri
damn.
And Okoye both. Yes. Like, Okoye's like, I could be conspicuous, and Shuri's like, really? I don't think so. But fantastic. Yeah.
It was so good. And then making fun of her makeup and it being ashy, I was like, stop it. Why are y'all doing this right now? It's too much. But it's just all of it, right? And then all of a sudden she's wearing the damn Midnight Angels outfit. When I was like, she hated this. She loved her red. Why are you doing this to her? What's going on? Because in my mind, I was like, wait, is she maybe not part of the Dor Milaje? Is that why the Midnight Angel is here? But, in reality, they're a special unit within the special unit. So maybe not, but it just didn't track as well. And I didn't like the blue with all what we have been seeing the whole movie and how powerful the Dor Milaje have been. I think it could have just been the Dor Milaje being badass, and that's fine.
It felt out of place a little.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't distract too much because it was just like a literal 2 minutes of movie, but I was like, that's kind of weird that they're just all of a sudden here. And because I know the comic lore, it was like there's a lot that goes into that. I wish we could have had more time to tackle that in another property.
Yeah.
Especially when we're fighting blue people. Suit, you feel me? So just visually, if we're wanting to do not a good guy versus bad guy, but Wakandans versus what are we calling them, right? Then I need it to be a versus, and I don't need it the lines to blur as a dumb me being I need a dumb it down for me a little bit, then that's how I'd like it. But either way, was it cool to watch? Obviously.
Yes, of course.
I thought, the action in this movie I thought was pretty fantastic, from the chase scenes to the fights. Obviously, the opening fight was incredible. I think the thing with the Midnight Angels and stuff, I was about to call them Blue Angels because you said blue so much. I was like, that's something different. This heads into something which is an interesting discussion point, because Jason, I think you and I had a similar thought about where the movie was going to go. But the movie did a good job of establishing the threat of the Talokanians, right? Because they are fast and strong, and Namor especially extremely powerful. As M'Baku points out, they don't call him king or you know, what, I forgot what the other one was, but they call him like
Kalukan.
Kalukan.
Yeah, like, he's a god. He's a serpent god. Yeah.
He is their god, right? Like, so there's a lot there. And like, one of the most like showcase of how powerful they are, of course, but M'Baku tries to attack them, attack Namor specifically when they come to Wakanda, and Namor just like one punch mans him.
Yeah.
Like into oblivion.
Like into oblivion.
Just yeets him across the village.
Yeah. It's wild. And so the idea of like establishing their strength levels and what the Wakandans have to face, it became like, well, they can't just fight them as normal. And M'Baku gets an upgrade where he has the titanium mace, basically, or vibranium mace. Shuri, of course, becomes a Black Panther. The Midnight Angels are suits that can help. And of course, Ironheart is there. Like the idea of upgrading so that they can stand toe to toe. That's
and
why.
Still getting beat.
And they're still getting beat, right?
Embarrassingly, okay?
So I think that that's why it happened. I thought, and the way they were going to go, and which could have been a solution that would not have incorporated the Midnight Angels, is that I thought ultimately it was going to be like, listen, T'Challa has giant shoes to fill. I don't think it's one Black Panther. I think it's Black Panthers. And I think several people are about to take the herb now that Shuri can recreate it. And I thought it was going to end up in a situation where it was going to like, Shuri, Okoye, M'Baku, and Akia, maybe, right? Like, I thought like that's where it would go, and we'd have like the Black Panthers, and that's how they can stand toe to toe against Namor and the rest of them. But
yeah, especially since we've established that Black Panther isn't necessarily just the royal family; it's a mantle that anyone can really take on if they, I guess, are, for lack of better words, a pure of heart or whatever you want to call it. So yeah, pre-movie, I definitely had that thought.
Yeah.
When we didn't know that Shuri was going to be the Black Panther, that was definitely a thought that was in my head.
Yeah, same here. So I think, like, if I were to, like, make one thing, I was like, okay. But thematically, I see where they were going, right? And it ultimately, it does work for me. But I definitely thought they were going to, like, multiple Black Panthers level, which would have been really interesting. But I think, like, that's why they had to throw in the Midnight Angel suits and all that, right? It's for effect of how do they stand the chance, which honestly, I could take early, right? Like it's something that I thought could have been gone either way. And it didn't really, I think, enhance it too much. The one thing I will note as we are on this though, is, Aneka, I believe. I will just say real quick, I do not have the, obviously, like my experience cannot speak fully to this moment. I'm sure for many people it was probably important, but the reveal that she was in a relationship with one of the other Dora Milaje was another one of those Disney. You either commit to it or you stop, because like this whole thing where it's like you got a scene that's easily cuttable from any other country that doesn't want it is just like get out, stop doing it like this. It really started to piss me off.
So the interesting thing about that is the person that, you know, that she was kissing, she kissed her on the forehead or something, was like, is Io, who seemingly has taken Okoye's spot as the general in the Dora Milaje. Now, in the comics, Aneka and Io are a couple, and they are the Midnight Angels. And they start out as a countermeasure to, they start out being Dora Milaje, and then they turn on the Dora Milaje, and they're actually opponents of T'Challa and Wakanda for a while until they come back around into the fold, and it's a very complicated story. I'm not gonna get into the whole thing,
but it's a comic,
yes. So I thought for them to take this turn with it, I wasn't a fan of it. I would have preferred to be more closer to the comic book storyline, and like I keep saying, to be tackled in the next movie and not as shoved into this movie. And giving Okoye AO spot, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been, I think, a much more interesting route, right? Like, they did put a lot in here. I did want to talk real quick, and this was talked about, out of all the actions that we saw, the ending fight between Shuri, now in the Black Panther outfit, versus Namor was brutal and incredible. And I've heard a lot of people talking about this fight online. Some person tweeting out is the most brutal fight in the MCU. I probably put it close on par with, like, to me, the most just like brutal physical fight is maybe this one and No Way Home. That fight in the apartment complex when Green Goblin Spider-Man was something I had not seen in the Marvel Universe before, because like that fight was not like we're fighting to win a fight. That was literally Peter was like, I'm fighting to not die.
Yeah.
And that is like intense. It was brutal and violent and rough in a way that I had not seen the MCU do before.
I think I might put the three-way fight between Tony, Steve, and Bucky up there as well. If we're just like semi-ranking things.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I don't know.
It's a well-choreographed physical fight. I love that fight. I think it's the most emotionally weighted fight is that one. But like in terms of like just pure physical brutality, it's like, to me, it's like these two stand above only for that reason.
Yeah.
But like in terms of fight.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, her getting impaled and ripping one of his little foot wings off.
And if I'm thinking about like this phase, I'm like, this phase upped the kind of violence a little bit. I think if I'm thinking about the different type of movies, I'm thinking about like Doctor Strange and, you know, Multiverse of Madness, where we're, you know, we're not showing it, but we're cutting someone in half with a cap shield. Like a lot of brutality in these sets of movies here.
I
will say, I think for me personally, this fight felt more brutal because it wasn't their, you know, it wasn't their fight to fight. It was actually they're fighting a bigger issue, right? Of outsiders coming in. And then that's why this is more brutal to me than maybe the other fights, because it's two people of color, two leaders fighting each other when, you know, over
the Americans.
Yeah.
Even just Americans, it's a joint force trying to mine vibranium. That's what started.
Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. So to me, it's like, how are we, you know, that's the thread that made it more brutal, because we're playing into the hands of the colonizers, correct? Because we're literally, it's divide and conquer. That's the motto. That's a British motto. And the fact that we are literally dividing ourselves and saying, okay, one powerhouse versus another, let's deplete each other so that the third can come in and make it easier. Because imagine, right, if Namor was gone, if she literally dried his ass out, then what would it would be so easy to mine all of it.
Like power vacuums, destabilization, like a constant struggle between the two. It's easy cleanup for anyone else at that point.
Yeah, so to me, that's why it felt way more brutal, where I was like, can we just, like, go to therapy real quick and, you know, bring in the abomination? Because at this point, I just need y'all to understand that you're fighting each other instead of the bigger issue. And that's where the movie, right, like, is, like, constantly pushing us into almost going there. But then there are no conversations about it, I feel.
This fight also, the brutality of it, also reminds me of one thing I do want to talk about, because why avoid talking about idiots online? One thing I did see, because of effing course this is out there. I try to avoid reading too much about, like, you know, ignorant morons commenting on things. However, I did see, like, a few comments on a thread I was looking at that would, the usual complaining about, like, oh, like Shuri was able to take on Namor, you know, and beat him after, you know, she just took the heart and she has the suit now. And it's just like, what fight did you watch? Because it's not like she was just handily beating him. No,
she struggled.
Brutality. She got impaled. Like the brutality of that moment is so intense. And it's just one of those things where she won by outmaneuvering and outthinking, not on physical capabilities. And I think that really works. But of course there's these people, because it's, of course, a sexist and racist misogynist idea that they're always trying to push. What makes me laugh about these assholes, by the way, I feel like the same people who sometimes say a lot of this stuff are like, there's that study out there, two studies, that was like a measure of how many, like, you ranked, like, by animals, do you think you could beat them in a fight? And, like, I feel like it was, like, 30% or, like, too high of a number.
I know what you're talking about.
Of dudes, said that they could take a grizzly bear. I bet. Like that, and the other one is like, do you think you could beat Serena like Williams in a tennis match? And there's like, again, a percentage of dudes who are like, I think I could. And it's just like, this is the same dudes who would complain about this and Shuri being able to do this. I bet there is a Venn diagram overlap circle between those same people who could be like, but I could take a grizzly or beat Serena Williams. I feel like same assholes.
Here's the joke, you losers, right? It's there's a reason why she did not fight M'Baku at the end of the movie. All right, wake up, everyone, because the point is she took a special serum to get here. If you believe Captain America can do it, Shuri can do it too. Yep. Wake up, geniuses. Like, yeah, just for a second. All right, because she, and we get the main baddie, allegedly, he's not the main baddie, but in the movie, Namor tells us the Black Panther is the most powerful being. He says that line. What more do y'all need? If the baddie himself is saying, shit, you know, you took the herb, it's a wrap for me now. So why are you not understanding that brains led us here?
And that they have a lot of them in their own.
Yeah.
Watch well, it. I mean, watch
and
it.
She knew that she had to weaken him to be able to beat him one-on-one. Like
she put him in a heater in the airplane. They literally gave a 1 whole second worth of the movie to the heater.
Yep.
So what more do y'all need?
And he was already weakened when they started fighting on the beach.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
People have no, I don't think they really paid attention or care. I think they're, of course, just spouting their usual.
They said black women can't be powerful.
Exactly.
Impossible.
It's nonsense. I don't know. That's the only thing I saw, because I don't really want to delve deeper into like what people are saying. But like, I'm sure there's enough morons who are commenting on something.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a lot of like, oh, why do you hate white people?
Did you watch
history?
The movie? Sort of explain why pretty solidly here.
Listen.
Yeah, I'm sure we're probably gonna get people who might even comment here to be like, the three of you hate white people. It's just like, first of all, I'm married to a white person. Second of all,
I'm a white friend.
Yeah, that's the way to do it, right?
Listen, I'm half white, so only half hate them. So
My god, I'm dead. I am fully Indian, but guess what? Colonizers took my country, and there's a lot of trauma in my body and my family history. So that's why. No, I'm just kidding. Obviously, we don't hate white people, but yeah, we hate white supremacy. If you think that's an issue, the issue is with you, my guy.
Yes, agreed. So what else do we want to touch on in the movie here? Jason, anything sticking out that we skipped or missed or anything big?
What did y'all think of the illustration of Talokan, like what we saw it be actually when we got down there and checked it all out? What was your impression of that?
I loved it only because it was not what I expected. I think there's a visual of underwater cities that has been shown, like whether it be Atlantis via the comics or even like Aquaman, right? There's a level of structure and buildings that still feel like it's a city underwater. And certainly if it's the myth of Atlantis, that makes sense because of the city that's like. What is interesting about Talokan is like you have architecture that is based clearly on the native culture, but it felt so much like a actual place that would exist within a water world, right? Like there's just some way about like how the levels of it were and how they existed and the floating, like it felt like this was structured with the, and it's what they did with Wakanda, right? How do you build a city that has not been touched by the outside world, and how does it advance in its own way? And I think they did a really cool job of that, in my opinion, here. It really felt different than what I've seen before, and I really liked it for that reason.
Yeah, I wanted to spend a little more time there. I felt like it was very quick, blink and you miss it. And it felt like, even though you guys have vibrated, like if we look at Wakanda and we see what they've done with the technology.
Right.
But we see that the, you know, Talokanians haven't really done that. It's still very kind of, it feels a little primitive a little bit.
They haven't had to, right? I think that's why. Where I have to say, shout out to the score of the movie, because when we get to the city, we get, you know, Con La Brisa starts, and what an amazing song to walk us through it all. And then it turns out that Ryan Coogler actually learned how to swim to deep dive with everyone to be able to shoot all of this. And then the actress that plays Namora, sorry, I don't have her name pulled up right now, but she can hold her breath for 6.5 minutes.
That is bomb.
Yeah. So listen, one thing I'll do is look all this stuff up. But it's just, to me, all of that stuff coming together, right, to build this beautiful city. And then that shark throne that he sits on. Oh my God. Like when he comes down, right? Like seemingly from Earth, not Earth, but like from the surface, but not actually into his throne. And then the chant and the fact that Shuri is allowed into this world. He genuinely sees, Namor sees some good in her. And then the friendship bracelet, right? His mom's bracelet that he gives her. It's just all of those, no pun intended, the threads that they're tying us through to see that Wakanda and Talokan could actually be this beautiful powerhouse together. And their allyship is amazing. And then, you know, for it to all fall apart, but wow, you know, wow. And the amount of, again, they didn't need to do all this. Like no one needed to learn how to hold their breath for 6.5 minutes, but to be authentic, to give us this visually pleasing masterpiece, they needed to. So, oh, I'm obsessed with it. I'm just obsessed with how they shot it. And the fact that the first fight scene took 4 months to shoot, y'all. That's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's because they kept reshooting it so many times because they wanted it perfect, but I'm just obsessed with all of it. And I want more. Like, can we get when we get the assembled, I hope we get a lot of here's how we build Talokan.
So that's where I got a little upset at the movie a little bit, because we spent so much time on Val and Everett. I was like, we could have cut that a little bit and shown more of Talokan. We, so much stuff that we did, we could have cut back. The Midnight Angel stuff could have cut back, because I just felt like we could have seen more. I wanted to see more of Talokan and that world. I just don't know if I got enough of it.
Yeah, I will say a quick shout. It's Mabel Cadena, who plays Namora, and of course, Tenek Huerta,
I wanted more Namora and Atuma, because, Atuma being the general to Namora, because they're characters in the comics. They're big characters that relate to Namor. And I feel like we didn't get any of that. Like, I wanted some more character building of those two as well. They just seemed like, regular henchmen for Namor, and weren't given much texture. There was a little bit of chemistry between Atuma and Okoye, where they're trying to best each other and several times in the movie, but it felt hollow on Atuma's end because I didn't get any other characterization from him.
I definitely want to give credit though, right? Like, this conversation sort of proves how great this movie is, because it is clocking in at 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And honestly, I never once felt the length. Right. I felt everything paced really, really well. Everything floating through. And here we are saying we would have loved more of X, Y, and Z, because it could have used a little bit more even. So credit to being able to pull that off. I definitely hear what you're saying. And I think I would have loved that too, right? Like a super long extended cut here, just see so much more, like a Lord of the Rings extended edition or something. Because there's so much to delve into. There's so much world here. And I think that's so incredible and amazing to be able to build these worlds and want us to see more and expand more. Certainly I see the point of the Ross and the Everett Ross and Val stuff. I found it very, the parts that were there amusing. And I think there was a little bit of there was there for comic relief too. Not to say this movie, as much as the serious stuff we're talking about, is very funny. They have phenomenal lines, and everyone is able to kill it with the comedy extremely well. So I always appreciate that, where the movie is able to balance that comedy and the action and the drama.
Did you think we would get a Thunderbolts direct tie-in at some point with Val? An end credit scene where we're we'll go take the vibranium ourselves, and then we see a one shot of the Thunderbolts team, or something like that.
I thought for a moment they would, and I might even say maybe they filmed it, but I'm glad that they cut it. Because again, I think especially with the ending of this film and what this film ended up being, having it be this is its own thing. Because there is a post-credit scene, which we should probably talk about.
Yeah.
But it's not one that's meant to be here's setting it up. I think I joked to Josh that you guys were on this thread where he was not able to see it until after we recorded, because he's on vacation. He's like, I've avoided all spoilers. And I was just like, oh, you didn't see the post credits of Tony Shalhoub as Galactus? And it's horrible. Just like, that's what almost like some of it feels like, where you have like Harry Styles showing up and you have Charlize Theron showing up. You're just like, are they just finding celebrities and throwing them into these movies? So yeah. I was like, what's the most ridiculous thing I could think of? But still at the same time, sort of plausible. I was like, totally. Tony Shalhoub is the voice of Galactus. Why not?
Yeah, I literally had to Google because, you know, I'm so scared of spoilers. So I didn't look up like the post. I always, during the credits, will look up how many post-credit scenes are there. So I was like, I'm reading. It's only one? Why? What happened? Because in my in my mind, I said, no, Thunderbolts for sure is coming. Like, why did you waste all this precious real estate to not give me a Thunderbolt? Not that I'm saying I wanted it, but why did y'all waste so much time, right? She bugged the beads. She like on his ass constantly. And he's over here risking his life, his job to help Wakandans because he owes them his life for nothing, you know, for no payoff, honestly.
And that part felt a little too cute too, where Val was like, I had the beads bugged even before you got there. I was like, okay, that feels a little too wonderful. I didn't know that. I didn't think that for sure. No, she not left for sure.
When she leaves him in the car for him to call, the first time I was like, oh, why did she leave so easily? That's so obvious that she needs him to make the call.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like it all felt a little too cute in that aspect, where Val's on top of it all because she's like the best super spy in the world. So, I mean, like, yeah, I'm kind of down on the Val Everett Ross parts if you didn't get that from my commentary so far. But I actually appreciated the restraint they showed in not having an end credit scene. Just because that mid-credit scene was so impactful and so important that it felt good that it was a standalone type of thing. That we didn't get some like, oh, no, next up in the MCU, the Thunderbolts. Like, I felt like it was more impactful because we got that on its own.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if part of this is also a release schedule thing, because Wakanda Forever technically was supposed to come out like way before it ended up coming out. But like delays and everything else and COVID. So I wonder if this is one of those things of like timing of like where Val was supposed to show up at certain points and how quickly and how frequently, because like she's appeared a lot more than intended. Like her original first appearance was supposed to be Black Widow, but that ended up being like Falcon Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
So like, I wonder how much reshuffling has sort of affected some of that stuff. It's really hard to say for sure. But again, like I think again, it's my bias is just towards Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Martin Freeman, both of whom I don't want to sound objectifying. However, both of these people, good God. Okay. Julius Dreyfus has always been attractive. Martin Freeman was always attractive in that like dorky dude kind of way, obviously from the original Office. And like, he's been in so many things. He just has a look to him, right? I don't know if it's the Marvel movies. He has obviously slimmed down considerably, but that man has silver fox like nobody's business. And even watching Veep for a long time with Julius Dreyfus, I'm just like, God damn, Julia, like, just both of them are like two people where I'm just like, you both have like aged into also like great, like it's insane. Good for them.
I can just think of him as the Hobbit. That's why I can't get over it ever. And I'm not on the same plane, but Julia, obviously, I'm with you on that. And it's so obvious we don't hate white people because look at us.
Yes,
look
at us.
So listen, as much as I like am hating on it, the scenes were acted brilliantly, of course.
Well, yeah.
There's no other way it could have gone for those two. Like, and for them to have been a formerly married couple was like such a fantastic revelation.
Yeah.
I think in the comics she is tied to Nick Fury. I think she is Nick Fury's ex in the comics. So that revelation was fun. I just don't know if I needed it here in Wakanda Forever. I think maybe I would have appreciated it. A Secret Invasion. I do believe Ross is going to come up in Secret Invasion, if I'm not mistaken. He's going to play a part in that.
That's what people are saying. We'll see.
Yeah, I just would have appreciated it somewhere else, not in this movie.
Fair. Since we haven't talked about it, actually, let us talk about real quick the post credits, mid credits scene, which is as the movie ends, Shuri finally is hitting that final phase of acceptance culturally. You burn the funeral clothes you wore on the 1 year anniversary. She goes to Haiti where, oh my God, I can't believe I'm blanking. Nikia, thank you.
Oh, okay.
I was like, I'm blanking on the character name. Currently lives, she had left Wakanda during the snap. and had never returned even for the funeral. And but Shuri goes there because she returns during all the course of events. And the final act is her burning those funeral clothes. That's where we get the montage of Chadwick as T'Challa, which was just impactful. And that's where the movie ended. In the mid-credits screen or scene, she shows up and she brings with her a small boy. And the moment the boy shows up, I was just like,
oh shit, here we go.
Yeah, same. I was just like, oh, like it was.
We knew.
Yeah, especially like looking at the age, I was like, that looks like an approximately 6-year-old child. Yeah.
But so, like in the trailers, I mean, Kevin, you haven't seen it.
I have
but
not.
There's a scene that we saw with a baby being born. Turns out it was Namor. And as we're seeing the trailers, we're like, oh my god, is that T'Challa's son? Like, is that T'Challa's child? Like,
that's what I said. I swear I said this. I was like, we're gonna see T'Challa's son. I don't know where I said it. Damn it, but I agree because I also saw that scene, and I was like, no, that's Nakia giving birth. I refuse for you to tell me anything else.
I thought for sure that was it. Then the movie comes like, oh, that was Namor. I guess we're not getting T'Challa's son. And then like at the end, it's like, oh no, he's here. Like that's him. Because I mean,
guess what?
Yeah, I think a lot of us would have assumed that this could happen, right? Like that. We off screen, they could have had a child to continue the legacy of T'Challa. I think all of us went to this thinking that was a possibility. And then we go through the whole movie. It's like, oh, no, not there. Okay, that's cool. That's whatever. And then to get it at the very end, I was like, oh, my God, that's so fantastic. Now my small quibble.
Ooh.
If I'm Shuri, I'm like, y'all couldn't tell me? Like, everyone else knew in my family, T'Challa, Ramonda. I was the only one that was left in the dark. Why is that?
Yeah.
So I believe were different times where she was going to, where Ramonda was going to tell Shuri.
Definitely during the burning. That was
exactly.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. Now that you said that, I was like, I have something to tell you about your brother. I was like, okay. Boom.
Yeah. There you go. And interestingly enough, it's a scene with elephants, which are known to be very masterful. I don't know if that's the right word. Grievers, actually, because they visit the site of the dead or their dead every year. So again, they're killing me with how good they are at this subtle imagery. But yeah, so I believe there were at least twice that she was going to tell Shuri. So
like, wow, we have to keep her in the dark at all. I was like, that was weird. I also wonder a little bit if this was kind of a late addition to the story, because we get Ramonda visiting Nakia, and it's like, hey, where were you? There was no, and she's like, oh, you know, I just didn't feel like I should be there. And it was no, like, no, because he told me to keep the kid away from Wakanda for a while. Yeah. Like, you know, it felt like this maybe could have been a late addition. I don't know, because I think that would have been something that a scene that could have been shared with Ramonda in the main story if this was a thing beforehand. But I don't know. I'm not sure. What do you guys think?
I mean, I liked it as a tribute. I think it's really great. I think it makes sense. I love the idea of the again, this speaks to T'Challa, right? The idea of like I grown outside of Wakanda, but knows about his past and his people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, again, part of that story, the idea of being a part of the outside world, but still knowing where you're from and how you connect and live with the two. He is, again, to me, that represents the lesson he learned from Killmonger, I think, in that first one, which also, we touched on it briefly, but just like, I cheered the moment I saw Michael B. Jordan. Yes. Goddamn, I love that character and I love him as an actor. So it was just like, hell yes. So I really liked it because like when he says that it's not like he doesn't know about his people in past, he does. And I like that is a big part of it. Mm-hmm. There is that that question of like, it's that purposeful avoidance, right? That sometimes happens. I don't think they did it overtly so in the dialogue here. I think there is the scene you mentioned, Jason, for sure. But it didn't like, it doesn't break me enough away from like the occurrences to like seem completely out of place. I thought it was a great tribute, especially like the idea of the legacy continuing and things like that. I thought was very touching.
Yeah. And I was, like I said, I watched this with my mom. So my mom's immediate reaction, and you wouldn't tell your mom the queen? And then immediately they were like, and she knew.
Yeah. So like, oh, okay. Yeah. They had to get that in there. Like, did mom know? Like, oh yeah, she totally knew.
Mm-hmm. And then I have to say also, we haven't touched a lot, but on Nakia and what a badass she was, because all these people, right, like Okoye is, you know, got reamed by the queen, but for losing her daughter, even their daughter maybe willingly went, whatever. And
I didn't love that, because like Ramonda didn't stop Shuri from Ramonda didn't like say you can't go. It was like she said, okay, fine, like after Okoye convinced her, I can see why she's mad, but just strip her up for like their general rank. I was like
you're doing the absolute most, and it's just maybe there's some, you know, unhealed trauma coming out.
I'm sorry, wait a minute. Are you telling me that you haven't experienced a mom overreact on something?
Let's move on. Let's not get canceled. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, exactly. So anyway, but then Nakia shows up and she goes, yes, just give me one business day and it's done. I got you. Right? Because how easily, right? 6 years out of the game, but she's back in and she said, I'm going to be the spy.
She's like, pulling his glasses, like, pretend I'm some, like, research person.
Right? I'm in. And Lupita Nyong'o does speak Spanish really well. So it's just, like, all of it works so well. And what a badass. But she's able to kind of bring her spiritual self with this badassery. And I think the way that character was able to create that. And then Nakia and the Queen Mother, you did start the fight. I have to say, you killed two people
for sure. Okay. I mean, I think that's the thing, right? Like, it is like, where does it, like, the vengeance and the idea of like retaliation and stuff, and like, again, fighting not right with the common enemy, can lead down this path, as opposed to try and outreach and diplomacy or some other path forward. Which, again, I just want to clearly state, because I will always clearly state, I don't think reaching across the aisle or trying to find a path forward with any sort of white supremacist is the answer.
Hell no.
Just specifically with other people who aren't white supremacists, I can get behind. But just want to clarify, because some people think we should just both sit together at a table. And I'm just like, maybe not. I don't know. I actually do understand where Ramonda's coming from when she's mad. And it isn't like a rational anger, but it is someone coming from someone who lost everything, and it is the idea of her saying like, I'll come on, it'll be fine, let her go out, and if something happens, you're gonna get pissed. So I think it was reactionary and extra, but I get it from like someone who has lost their entire family perspective, you know. So I
but she didn't have to shade her to be like, your little traitor husband, I know you know him. No, that's who you lay with, like, what? Come on. And I love it because the man didn't want to come back for the movie. So I guess you had to know where his character was gone. I was like, oh, why you did that to him?
Yeah, I don't know what the deal is there. Like, maybe there wasn't enough also for him in the script or whatever. Or
no, I think he was shooting Nope.
Nope. Yeah, that's what I figured.
That's what Daniel Kaluuya was. But then we see a jellyfish. No, wait, spoilers. Nope, spoilers. But we see a jellyfish at the start of the movie, which I was like, wonder where I've seen that. So if you've seen Nope, you know what I'm talking about. I guess I'll just say that.
All right, let's see. Any other stuff that we missed? Because like
M'Baku.
Oh, good God! Oh, yes.
Okay, I was like, I'm ready. Good. Don't worry.
Yeah.
So is he officially king? Is that what we're supposed to surmise from this?
That's what I thought was happening, which would be really interesting to see, like how it moves forward and like what they do with this. Because I kind of like the idea of like him being king and her being the protector. I think is very interesting. Yeah.
And separation of church and state, I appreciate that a lot.
And to see him really step up to be like a counsel for Shuri after her mom dies was such a great move for that character. And it's not even a move that is like out of left field. It feels like the natural progression for that character, that he's on the outside, this like brash, just like kind of a-hole. But you know, when it comes down to it, he's going to step up and be like the guy he needs to be.
Yeah, I think M'Baku is one of my favorite characters ever because, and Winston's M'Baku, maybe I'll say that, Winston Duke's M'Baku, because it's so funny. Like, the first scene we see him in, man is chewing a carrot, right?
Well,
because,
carrot.
Because he's a vegetarian.
Who else could communicate through grunts the way that he does and it'd be so effective?
God, and he's obviously so attractive, right? Like, my God. All right. And I feel that if I were a ruler, I would want to be incarnated as an M'Baku. I don't know what that says about me, but here I am. And the fact that I think the subtle nods to Hanuman is cool to watch. And again, I'm watching it with my mom, who's Indian. We're both Jewish, but we grew up in India. So my mom is like, Hanuman. And she's just like yelling. I'm like, shh, you're in the movie. It's like, please, let's not do this. And to be able to, even the mourning, he has like white around his arms. That's like something Hindus do when they are mourning. So it was just amazing how they're, again, able to weave all of this. But M'Baku's growth, right, from like this grunting man on the side, this ruler, to actually being part of his culture, right? Because there was always supposed to be six tribes, right? Yeah. And one of them, six or five, sorry.
It's five.
Five.
That's five. Yeah. The Jabari land people were like on the outside.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Like, right. I was like, is it four? Yeah. Anyway, so five. And, you know, the Jabari to really be on the out. But now they're like, no, we can exist as we want to be while still being part of the bigger microcosm. And I think he is a big reason for that bridge. And just like, what a badass, the way he fights. But he's also so funny. He's like, Fishman is here. I got to kill him. It's so good. And like, give him his flowers, man.
Yeah. I mean, just the way he just, every line out of him is fantastic. Yes. And brilliant in the way he speaks. Obviously, just the, what is it? Just because we live in the mountains doesn't mean we don't have access to books. It's really great. Just like a very, like, we know things. I thought was phenomenal. And yeah, I mean, for me, like, ever since the first movie, that Hanuman representation is like ecstatic for me. I talked extensively about that on the original Black Panther podcast, but like, it's so incredible to hear that name in a mainstream movie. Like, Hanuman is probably my favorite Hindu deity. I have a book, a notebook in the like background over there. It's a little higher than the video camera with Hanuman. And like, he's just a very cool character for me. I've always liked that character, and so the seed of representation here in this movie has been amazing. Like, even to like little things like Hanuman is like ape-like, but like the gorilla representation and the statue in the background, stuff like that, the vegetarian. And I pointed this out, the fact that he fights with a mace, because that's what Hanuman uses, is all these like little things, and I absolutely adore it. So like, I love that character just for that level of representation alone. And again, being able to like historically trace that back. Because, like, I looked it up afterwards because I was curious. And, like, yeah, there is tribes in Africa that have Hanuman as a deity. Like, it is a thing that's spread. So it just shows a level of care and research that really, truly goes into both of these films and that is put into it that is so, so deeply appreciated. But I want so much more M'Baku all the time. Like, that's another one where I'm just like, oh, give me more of that happening. And, again, I was curious, like, if they were going to do like the Black Panthers situation, like how does that shape out? Like what would that be? But the idea of him possibly being a ruler while Shuri's protector, I think is really interesting as well. I mean, it just gets me jazzed for the future as always, in a way that I don't think a lot of the Marvel films for me have been doing. Certain ones, sure. But like, this is such a like well done, and not just the future of the MCU, but specifically the future of Wakanda and what they're gonna do. As long as like these people are involved, as long as Ryan Coogler is involved, that's what I keep wanting to see, and I hope we get to see more of as we move forward. This one ranks very high for me in Phase 4 specifically. I think it ranks high in general, not as high I think as some of my like tops, but certainly for Phase 4. I think it's this Love and Thunder for me that are like my favorites. And I know Love and Thunder is divisive with a lot of people, but my reasons for liking that are my own. But this one, I think, is just, it's fantastic. Possibly the top, you know?
Yeah, I think for me in Phase 4 specifically, at this moment, it always feels like when I walk out of the theater, I'm like, that was fantastic. And then I think about it more, and I'm like, it goes down the ranks a little bit. But for me at the moment for Phase 4, this is at the top. And it's Wakanda Forever is a fantastic movie, but it doesn't have to do a lot to get to the top of the phase four ranks for me. So yeah, it's definitely up there for right now. I don't know where I would put it in the overall MCU for me. I had to think more about that before I, you know, go that far. But it's going to be definitely in the top half, maybe in the top quarter of MCU movies for me. I do think this is a fantastic movie. Like I've been saying this whole podcast, I think there were some things you could have trimmed off and added more things that I would have liked to see. That's probably my only real criticism, if you could trim some fat and add some more stuff in. But other than that, it was a fantastic movie. I mean, I don't think we've spoken enough about Letitia Wright's portrayal here. For her to move from what in the first movie she was more of a, like, she's a little precocious, like, teenager who was a comic relief, and for her to really grow here and to show a lot of different sides of her and to show that level of grief and to question your faith as you are processing your grief and anger is something that I think a lot of people can relate to, and I think that she did it wonderfully.
Yeah, when she shows up right at the end and in the middle with the Black Panther suit on, I was like, it's done. Where do I follow you? To the end of the earth, to that damn boat, I'm here, right? Because again, her Black Panther feels so different because she sees Killmonger, right? Oh my God. When Killmonger showed up, I think the whole movie theater gasped because I definitely didn't know that was coming. But it made sense, right? With the fire going while she's shown up in the ancestral. Is that ancestral plane? I don't want to call it that. It didn't feel that, but maybe it is. And then to be able to pull from that, and also, you know, which we talked about a little, right, of all the different Black Panthers and ancestors that she's pulling from to become her own, and then bringing science into that, it just feels like in 2022 and, you know, forward is where our superheroes should be going, is not necessarily just holding on to like superpowers, but also being dimensional in that they can really pull on being smart and being badass with smartness, because I feel like a lot of women, we don't necessarily always see that on screen a lot. And we know they exist, but I don't know that it's represented that well on screen. So finally we get like a badass Black woman that's a scientist, but also a Black Panther. And it's really cool to watch. And I do think she did a good job. Whatever her personal beliefs may be, we are.
And to speak a little bit about like the women in superhero movie tropes, I think this really skews away from a lot of, I think for Captain Marvel, they made it a point to be like, no love interest here. Like, this is just straight Captain Marvel. She's not like, you know, doing anything. And this love interest crap, because that's not what women are about. It felt like that was kind of hit us over the head with that in that movie. And then Black Widow is a little less hitting over the head. It's more just like, it's just natural. This is as natural can be. There's no there's no like, oh, because you're a girl, this and that. There's none of that. None of that. And I appreciated this movie for that a lot. There was never any question about, I mean, from the movie, inside the movie.
Right.
Of it. Questioning of like.
Real world, whole other situation. But yeah.
Yeah. The question like, can you do this because you're a woman? Like, there was none of that. So I really, really appreciated that about this movie.
Well, also, I think speaks so well about like Wakanda in terms of its own progressivism, right? Because like gender was never an issue, and I think that's even somewhat addressed in the first movie in a way, right? Like the idea of like gender norms isn't like built into Wakanda. They are futurists in so many ways, like socially and progress and economically, and technologically. And I also agree. Like I kind of am tired of that story trope that needs to almost exist to be like, oh, in this fictional world we created, sexism also will exist and we will address it as if it was real. And it's just like, or you could just not do that because it's a world you made up. The same thing when people are just like, how can Black people exist in fantasy? I don't understand the question. Yeah.
Oh my! But I also have to say, because this is another thing I saw online that I want to shut down. If any of our listeners are doing it, don't. The Shuri and Namor shippers. Let's fight. All right. Because absolutely not. This is so messy. This is gross on so many levels. And women are dimensional in that you can find a man that, listen, man's attractive, we know, but that does, he's 500 years old, okay, and she's stopped being a teenager yesterday, so let's understand that. Stop. And then people are like, oh, the Raylo shippers, Rilo, sorry, stop it. Stop it. You stop
it's
it right now.
A whole other conversation.
No,
yeah,
I know. Yeah, listen, don't. I'm not a star. Please don't come for me about that. But the point is, it is not equal. And that's weird. He killed her mom. Let's not forget. Okay. So let them just be. And like that shipping, I was like, it's disgusting. And I'm number one shipper of anyone and everyone. And even I'm saying that. Okay. So please.
Well, it felt like they for a millisecond. It was there.
Sure, when he was showing her around. But yeah. I'm like, come on. A man is being nice to a woman. The bar is in hell. That does not equal that they need to be a love interest. It's that he's just showing her around because he sees genuine good in her. And that's it. Come on, people. Stop. Don't ship them. That's gross. And her and maybe him and Nomura, because, you know, it's interesting. I'm into that. I'll write that fan fiction.
I mean, the comics, I think this was your cousin.
That's what I'm saying.
Cousins in comics. Which is
not by blood. I looked it up. Don't ruin my ship. Okay, get out of here. It's not, no, none of the Southern situation here. So it's all good. I'll allow it.
I'm in agreement about like not shipping these two. I don't think it's necessary in terms of like ships are always complicated because people when they ship stuff it usually means long term. Now if we're gonna have Namor like manslaughtered around, that's fine because that's actually his character.
It. Yeah, that fits the comic character.
That's
sure,
his deal. Him and Daredevil. That's just what they do, and I'm glad that they did that with Daredevil and She-Hulk as well.
I love it.
Just yeah, A pluses on those. So I agree about the not shipping. And like, yeah, I not every movie needs to have, I'm such a big proponent of not every movie needs to have a romance. It is the go-to studio note of like, you need to have a romance in here, followed closely by like, can we have an open narration? I would love to do away with those necessities, just in ad nauseum here and forever. So like, yeah, I agree about not shipping them. I just, again, like the portrayals of the characters and the acting is so good. Yeah, I will also like props out to Letitia Wright, who I think just did such a really, really, really good job picking up this mantle, this heavy, heavy mantle. And just, she's been a great actress, you know? And so like, I think that's been carried through. Obviously the real world stuff is frustrating, especially because she's Guyanese. It's just kind of like, God damn it. We had
one. Supposed to be a scientist.
Yeah, we're supposed to have one. Why are you doing this? It's like when M. Night Shyamalan is just like, we got one. And then he fell apart. And you're just like, please, damn God. It, come on. Just every time when one rises, another falls. So, yeah. But like acting-wise, this movie really, truly just across the board, the acting was out of control incredible, and obviously the attractiveness of everyone in this cast is also out of control incredible.
Doesn't hurt.
It's tops for many of those reasons. It really truly is a movie that we could just keep talking about too.
And last thing about that, like if a woman is gonna have a love interest, it needs to be from like the female gaze, not the male gaze. So you know, if like Shuri has a lot of agency in who maybe she, whatever, that's fine. Like Nakia, right? We see a lot of like Chadwick is like puppy dog eyes and she's kind of like, just like, calm down, dude, chill out, bro. Yeah. And then does end up, you know, having a baby with him. It's all good. So if it's in that gaze, then it's okay. But usually, unfortunately, these stories are written with the male gaze in mind. And, it, you know, there's a lot of erasure, right, of women and their pleasure. And that's when it gets annoying and messy. So if we're going to do a love interest, I need it to be well done. And this ain't it. Okay. Let her just like be the Black Panther. That's already a lot of stress. We don't need to add a relationship on top of that.
Agreed. Like that's the other thing is like so much the theme of the story doesn't necessitate it or center on that. And people will shove in relationships into a story and it detracts from the theme you're trying to say because you also have to then build a relationship. That's why so many relationships and movies fall flat because you don't have enough time to dedicate to them actually going through it and actually liking each other. You're just telling us that that's what has to happen because that's what the plot demands. And I'm glad that that was not a thing here and was not something that felt like it was a burden in the first one either. Like, Yeah, I would be happy to not have those elements anymore. I think most superhero movies are moving away from a lot of that, unless it's like vital. Like obviously there's relationship stuff in Spider-Man No Way Home, but like it's still different enough. Also another movie where it's just like science helping out.
Oh my god. Yeah, I'm not, like I said, I'm not mad. I like romance, but I just don't need it all the time. That's all.
Shipper's gonna ship, man. You can't stop it. The internet's gonna
No, I will fight these shippers. She's a child, you weirdos. Another Disney issue, right? But anyway.
Yeah, that's a whole other podcast about Disney's
exactly.
Youth, especially the princess eyes.
Coming to you soon.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. It's not. Oh my god. And the last thing for me, and then I really don't have anything else, is Toussaint's name. It's actually inspired by a enslaved man that was really prominent during his life, fought against the French. Haha, fun fact. Which is why I wonder if that's why they picked her to be in Haiti.
Because, interesting, yeah.
Yeah. And because, you know, French, that lady, man, her face was just pissing me off at the start at the UN. And anyway, he actually fought against France for Haitian independence.
So Toussaint is Black Panther, or T'Challa's son.
Yes.
Yeah. His Haitian name.
Yeah. So Toussaint, I'm not French speaker, please. But Louverture? I don't know how to say it. I'm so sorry, everyone. You can look it up. But the point is, that is where it's interesting, because we see France at the start of the movie being annoying and horrible. And then we have the child who's named after the father of Haiti, who helped start an enslaved person's rebellion into a movement.
In fact, and again, this movie is so deliberate with choices. I feel like this is also deliberate, right?
Yeah.
The French being the antagonist, and specifically Nakia living in Haiti, is, I think, purposeful, because the revolt you're talking about is, I believe, the only successful slave revolt in history.
Yes.
The only one that actually succeeded. So I think there is lots of levels to those choices as well, which I think is very fascinating, very interesting.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, I can't, like, as a comic book fan, I can't come on here and not talk about the comic book counterparts. For anyone like interested in that, I would point you to Reginald Hudlin's run on the character. I think that's probably the most like seminal run of Black Panther, and it reintroduces Black Panther to the Marvel Universe in an important way. The comic books from 2005 and all the way up until we get in that first Hudlin run is where we introduce Shuri, even the concept of Shuri, because even before then she wasn't even a character.
Yep.
Reginald Hudlin introduced her, and then going like a few years down the road is when Shuri becomes a Black Panther in the comics. So that whole Hudlin run, the Reginald Hudlin run, you can check that out to see what was different in the comics and all that good stuff. I just had to put that out there.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yep. I don't know what Namor comics I would even recommend on the flip side, because like that's harder. That dude
I think he's so different from the comic book character that you don't even have to dive into the comic book history of Namor, because it's so different. Besides the fact that he has little wings on his feet, that carries over, and the pointy ears, but everything else is a kind of a very different character.
Supremely different. He's a very great, in the comics, I think he's a great supporting character. It's hard to think of something that puts him in the front of the central part of the story that I was just like, ah, yes, that really sticks out.
Namor did become a big Black Panther villain at one point in the comics run, because he like destroyed Wakanda with a tidal wave in the comics. Like, I think that's where we get the fact that Namor is a Black Panther villain in the comics, and is kind of transported over here to the films. But you know, it's not, we didn't even get a big tidal wave here in this. It's mostly just like kind of like a light flooding, like it kind of felt like.
But the physicality of how they did it, right? Like that work and the siren's call, right? Like those dangers, I thought were really interesting. It's so like another reason I definitely thought with the comics that Reed Richards might be the person who shows up is because I believe like Black Panther first appeared in Fantastic Four, and Namor is a huge character in the Fantastic Four comics. So it was just like, oh, what a place if this is where the Fantastic Four show for the first time is, in fact, in Black Panther. I thought that'd be an interesting parallel, but sadly not. Who knows when we'll ever get them? Who knows when we're going to get real mutants? Who knows? Who knows? Well, I certainly don't.
They're all mutants, and that's it. That you get X-Men in every movie. That was
still
the wait, point.
Still waiting for the X-People whenever we get them.
I know. I guess, who knows? At this point, they're just teasing us. Stop it. Stop it. Stop using that word.
Literally, I'm over it. When I heard that, I actually rolled my eyes because I was like, no, shut up.
Yeah, stop teasing us. Just
exactly.
Stop it.
I don't appreciate it.
One day, I don't know. This is the thing. And this is why, I mean, like, because it's out of context enough in here, too, where, or just even in context of what a mutation is, and it works without being just like, ah, wink, wink. So, like,
he's like, I'm a mutant. I'm a mutant. I got mutated stuff. My ears are mutated. My feet are mutated.
I'm different. I don't turn blue. Like, see, it's just like, yeah, all right. You used a word correctly. But we know it means something else. We'd love for you to give us that something else at some point. All right. I guess that'll wrap us up here for Black Panther Wakanda Forever. Again, if you haven't seen it, I don't know why you listened to this, but you should go watch it. It's great. It is doing very well in theaters. I hope it continues to do well. This is the end of phase four of the MCU. I believe Quantumania is next, which ideally will finally tell us where the MCU is headed. And if it doesn't, I will probably tear all my hair out. But as far as like where we are here, I think this is a great spot for phase four to end on a high note, in my opinion. I really like it compared to a lot of other Phase 4 movies. I certainly will watch it again. Thanks to you two for talking about this with me.
Thanks for having us. I know, this was so much fun. A movie.
This was absolutely great, yeah. And you guys were carrying the mantle over there on the main Everything is Super feed with She-Hulk, which, again, thank you for covering that. If you guys haven't checked that out, definitely go check that out, both the She-Hulk show and our coverage. What else you got going on? You got anything else going on? You want people to follow you, not in real life, but on social media? Jason, where can people see you?
You can find me on Twitter at JAYR1085. My main gig at the moment is covering the reality TV show Made Her First Sight over on the A Perfect Match podcast. Check me out with my co-host Asia Welch over there. We're having a great time. Season's just about over this season, but you can check us out still. You can give us a shot, and we'll be back in a couple months for the next season. So check me out there. And anything else I have coming up, I will put on the Twitter.
Sasha, what about you? What you got going on?
Yeah, you can check me weekly over on Rob Has a Podcast / Mess Magnets, where Kristen McKenis and I are covering, daily pop culture, lots of mess, lots of just like vibes only, honestly, with these celebrities. Whatever mess they're up to, we're covering it, okay? So check all of that out. And over on Silent Podcast, I'm covering Never Have I Ever with Chappelle, and I'm covering The Amazing Race as well. So check all of that over on Silent Podcast. And everything else that I'm on, you can just find me on Twitter at funsize_04 to know all of it. This was so much fun. Thank you, Kevin and Josh, for letting us honestly come back.
Don't thank the colonizer for this.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, he's still in chains.
He's the back of the van, and we're not coming to get him. He's just gonna go to Guantanamo, wherever they're sitting.
He's on his own. As for me, you can follow me if you want on Twitter for however long that lasts, at Kev Mahadeo. I don't got to figure out what social media I'm going to promote next week, I guess.
I don't know.
Maybe. I should start posting on Instagram more. I'm just going to turn into a fashion Instagram. I've gotten way more into fashion, and this movie did not help, because it just makes me want to be like, I need to buy better looking clothes.
Same.
Beyond that, of course, Everything is Super will be continuing. We'll have coverages of various things as we move into the future. The most immediate, once Josh does get free, if you've listened to our Black Adam coverage, you know what's coming. But if you haven't, Josh and I recently talked about Black Adam, and it served as a great segue to actually, at long last, finally delve into the DCEU. So we'll be watching all the DCEU movies. Yep, that's right.
Oh, wow.
Feel sorry for you.
I know. Starting with Man of Steel, Superman movie we had not covered before. So we're starting there. We're going to be doing all the Snyder stuff. So Man of Steel into BVS, Justice League, both versions. I have never seen the Snyder cut, so this will be my first time watching it. Lord help me. 4 hours. Other than that, we got the Mighty Ducks Game Changer podcast on the main feed, actually, on the main feed. You can check out where Melissa Woodward and I are talking about the Mighty Ducks Game Changers on Disney Plus. We're on season 2 that we've been covering week by week. And on the Patreon feed, if you are a patron, which you can become by going to patreon.com/postshowrecaps, where you can find a number of patron-exclusive podcasts, including Who A, which is Melissa, myself, and Adam H. talking about Doctor Who. We're both huge fans of that series, and we've started with the Christopher Eccleston era and have been making our way through. We're doing essentially a curated list, so we're not doing every single episode. It's a great place for people who have been curious about getting into Doctor Who and how to get into and what episodes to watch. We're basically making it easy for you by telling you which ones to check out and then very quick recaps about anything important you missed in between. So check that out by becoming a patron. That's patreon.com/postshowrecaps. And that's it for us. So until next time, farewell, everyone. And remember, Wanda.